Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me today, as always, is my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Hello, forgive my sniffles.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you haven't been feeling very good this week, but yeah, hopefully, the Blood God is sympathetic, and there's nothing like a good RPG to make you feel better when you're not feeling terribly well.
That is true. I can relate.
I think I've related this on the podcast before, but one of my fondest gaming memories is when I was playing Twilight Princess back in like 2000, early 2007 or whatever. I had like a terrible case of the sniffles, and then I got to the Snow Peak ruins
with the
Yeti and the soup.
Yeah, soup.
Oh my god, it was like I was drinking hot soup while playing this game. It was amazing.
That was a good dungeon.
It was a good dungeon. I would say it's actually one of the best dungeons in Zelda.
I agree. It's just very, very atmospheric, very original. I really enjoyed it.
The best thing about it is that you don't even know that it's a dungeon until
it's done. It's like, is this a dungeon or isn't it? I don't care. It's good.
You realize it's a dungeon when you beat the mid boss and you get the mace, or was it the hammer?
No, it's like a ball and chain that destroys everything.
Yeah. So. In any case, after that little digression into Zelda, as usual, we're going to be doing a Persona 4 Golden Report.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be covering a little bit of RPG news, including Pillars of Eternity Deadfire, which is getting kickstarted. We're going to talk a bit about Pokemon Bank, because I'm back, baby! I'm back into Pokemon!
It's
happening again. Yes, it is. We'll talk about a bit about Ni No Kuni 2, which I got to see. And we will talk about Dragon Quest VIII, and kind of the coup de grace of this episode is an interview with Torment Tides of Numenera designer, and as well with Brian Fargo, because I went to a preview event a couple weeks ago, got to record an interview with them. We're going to talk a little bit about that. So let's do this, Nadia.
Nice.
All right. Persona 4 Golden Report. Let's do it.
Well, I went on a camping trip, and you were right, that was a curry and a half.
It was a true disaster, and one of the most memorable parts of the entire game.
Well, just the way they describe the textures alone, it's like, ew.
Yeah, right? I mean, they really did a phenomenal job of just capturing the humor of that entire thing.
Yeah, and I'm just glad that I had my very first Japanese curry before seeing that scene, so I never have to think about it.
You were probably thinking about like what like real curry tastes like versus whatever the heck they made.
Yes, but it did encourage me to look up curries around Toronto, and as it turns out, yeah, there are several around here, so I should probably get to that. But I also kicked off the part of the game with Rise.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be delving into that dungeon pretty soon, because she just went missing.
So one thing really quickly.
Sure.
I like that Yukiko is a bad cook.
Me too, because everyone was saying, oh, she'll be a good cook because she runs the inn, but she sucks.
I think it kind of humanizes her. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was already human. Like, we were already seeing the pressures that she's feeling and how she doesn't necessarily want to run the inn, but she's like being put under so much pressure to continue the family line, to be a good little girl, and to be able to do all of the things that a lady is able to do, right?
Yes, exactly. And
so the fact that she's like not instinctively perfect at it,
mm-hmm.
Makes me feel good, because I'm also not that great a cook.
I am an okay cook. I cook a lot of Hungarian food because that's what I grew up with. It's funny. My mother didn't know how to cook when she married my father, and my grandmother, who was Hungarian, taught her. So that's pretty much what I grew up on.
Hmm.
But I I am a good cook, but I just hate cooking. I can't be bothered.
Food of the Blood God. What was it last week that we were saying? Like the Food of the Blood God podcast?
Oh, the Spoon of the Blood God.
Spoon of the Blood God is in full effect.
Yep, yep.
But okay, anyway, back to what I was saying about Yukiko. She's an interesting, well-rounded character and very sympathetic in that regard.
Yeah, and it's actually funny how I was thinking about how much I do sympathize with her, because to have to, or to even want to turn your back on something like a traditional Japanese inn that's been around for hundreds of years, and to say, I'm not going to run this stupid place, I don't want to, like, that's gotta take a shitload of courage.
Yeah, absolutely. One reason that another thing that I wanted to point out from that scene is the way that they, like, wrote it, like, they really captured kind of the humor of the scene from the Japanese version.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it just goes to show, like, how freaking good the localization of Persona 4 really is.
Yes, I think a lot is riding on that localization, and they did really well with it.
Because without the right localization, it would have been just kind of dumb, right?
Yeah.
But the hilarity just, like, keeps building and building and building. It's sort of like trying to describe all of the horror of this particular curry, and so much is riding on the writing, right?
Yes.
I mean, you have the characters reacting, but whatever. Without the context, it's not as funny.
Yeah. No, they did really well with that. Especially one common theme I've noticed with Yukiko's cooking is there's always something there that you can't swallow. And they don't describe it exactly, and they shouldn't. But it's just horrifying to think of that, at least to me.
I don't understand how Yukiko managed to F up the recipe that badly.
Yeah, well, they were talking about, like, at the grocery store, like, oh, let's put, like, this in there, and let's put that in there, and, you know, to be honest, you could look up a recipe, but I don't think they bothered with that.
I will say that back in, like, 2009, we tried to make a curry ourselves, and it was an Indian curry.
Right.
And the result, it was like a paneer butter masala, and mm-hmm. the result was so bad and so demoralizing that we didn't clean the dishes for days, and it actually put us off cooking for, like, days after that, too.
Wow, what an epic curry.
Because it was thin and watery, and the taste wasn't right, and the actual, like the cheese, like, was really, like the texture was all wrong. Like, it was kind of flaky.
Uh-huh.
And it was on top of this bland rice. And we got, like, a couple bites into it, and we just stared at one another. And we're like, what have we done? What is this crap?
Oh my God.
That regard, perhaps I can understand how curry can go that badly wrong.
Okay, yeah, I can understand that. But, yeah, that was a curry that went very badly in the land of Persona. And then they all kind of went swimming in a way.
Yes.
More like
the whole camping trip thing is just hilarious. Talking about the translation aspect, I actually got an email from one of our listeners who describes himself as a freelance translator.
Oh, cool.
Who's currently translating iOS and Android Otome games into English for a company in mm-hmm. Japan. His name is Michael Ledvinka. And this is following on from my rant last week, where I was talking about how literal translations are not good and are often very boring. Mm-hmm. And he agrees with me. He says, not only are literal translations bad, they're also wrong. He mentioned that they're boring. That's the clue. Though Otome games aren't my cup of tea, rarely is the Japanese text I receive from the company employing me boring. It's usually fun, cute, and fairly endearing. But when I give it a literal translation, suddenly everything sounds so bland, so mm-hmm. dull. That's absolutely not how it sounds in Japanese, which means that if I translate it literally, I'm presenting an incorrect version of the original text. The most accurate translation possible, if that's what you're shooting for, will have the same meaning and produce the same feeling as the Japanese version.
Right.
Occasionally, it's not possible to do that perfectly, and you'll have to change the meaning to get the feeling right, or vice versa. Regardless, producing an accurate translation almost always involves adding words, taking away words, and changing the way things are phrased compared to a direct translation. A direct translation gives you a version of the Japanese text that is often warped beyond recognition. Mm-hmm. To get an accurate translation, you have to unwarp it. So, in any case, I totally agree with him. And
yeah, that's actually very interesting, because I was thinking about what we were talking about last week, and mm-hmm. It's like, I used to read a lot of, one of my earliest writing jobs was I was a manga reviewer, and I was also sent a lot of, like, Japanese books that were translated directly from English, and they were always very, very dry and very boring, but I was thinking about it, and it's like, if you watch Japanese movies, they're always acted so incredibly well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just the way Japan, so much rides on the tone and inflection of your voice versus the words you use. I could be wrong since I'm not really like fluent in Japanese at all, but yeah, that's just how it comes across to me.
The interesting thing about Japanese cinema, and I think that it falls into games too, one of my, I would call him a friend of the site, Kyle McLean.
Oh yeah, he's cool.
Fluent in Japanese, very into Japanese culture. We always make sure to get together with him when we're in Tokyo or whatever. And he said, he pointed out how different the theater traditions are from Japan versus America. Like the American or the Western tradition is from Shakespeare.
Right.
Which relies on like really flowery writing and everything.
Right.
Where the Japanese, like, the Japanese tradition is based more on, you'll forgive me, no plays? Is that what they're called?
With the masks?
I'm probably mangling it, but,
yeah,
you know, like, traditional Japanese theater is just very yes. different. And that carries into the writing, which is why you have characters kind of being really overwrought or
right.
explaining their feelings or being really over the top. And to the West, it's like, well, what's going on? Like,
yeah.
Why is this so cheesy? Like, we consider it cheesy, but, like, it's just coming from a different tradition. So it's I found that kind of observation really interesting.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. That's very interesting. I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes a lot of sense.
Which makes the job of localization even tougher.
I know. It's crazy to begin with.
And then often there are like in-jokes, mm-hmm. Like cultural in-jokes, references to memes that Americans wouldn't get.
Yes.
Like traditional like stuff. I was watching, what was it, Polar Bear Cafe.
Uh-huh.
And they had to have like notes like at the top of the screen, just like noting everything that what they were talking about in terms
yeah.
of like all of the jokes that they were making. Because it's just like, it's not perfect.
No, it can't be.
Suffice it to say, they nailed it with Persona 4.
They really did.
They nailed it with that camping scene.
Because, so. I mean, let's face it, like I was saying, if I didn't care about the characters, if I didn't find them funny or entertaining, I wouldn't be playing the game. Because that is a game that is like maybe 50% combat and 50% social links. I mean, they are straight up called social links.
Yes, they are. Like yeah. so much of it is riding on... Well, basically the connections that you're making with the characters and caring about their stories and wanting
yeah, exactly.
to know more. Yeah. So now, so Risei has come into the picture. So like, what's going on, Nadia?
Well, Risei is a pop idol who's come back home, quote unquote, to the tofu shop in on Main Street. And it's like, as Dojima says, what is with this town? It was so quiet and all of a sudden there's so much buzz around it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so she's working in the tofu shop, and she seems kind of downcast, and she's just gone missing after, on the Midnight Channel, she presented herself as, like, someone who's going to, quote-unquote, bear it all, so mm-hmm. that was a thing. Yeah, so we'll have to see where this is going.
So you haven't done the dungeons or anything yet?
No, that's coming up.
Hmm. Well, okay, I look forward to your thoughts. There's, what was it? There's a documentary that was just shown at the Sundance Music Film Festival.
Uh-huh.
Actually, that's a documentary about Japanese idol culture and Japanese kind of the, what was it, the maid culture, like, you know, like where people will go to cafes and like be waited on hand and
mm-hmm.
hand and foot by girls, and like the girls are trying to pick up fans.
Yes.
And mostly among like middle-aged like men who are just like they want a particular kind of lady
mm-hmm.
and like they like there's like a certain amount of time that you can shake their hand and everything.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying that Persona is like going to do like a really amazing breakdown of like that culture or anything, but it is touching on it.
Right, right.
So there are similar themes going on here.
I did have a quick question, though. See, I didn't really think about it, but I guess it could be the case. When you have, like, the closed-down sort of decrepit Main Street versus Juness, is like, the whole big box versus small business thing? I guess that's also a thing in Japan, isn't it?
I suppose. So when I was living in Japan, like, they kind of, like, were right next to one another. But then again, I lived in Tokyo.
Right.
So you had, like, your little traditional shops, like, in train stations, in, like, suburbs and everything. But then you also had your, like, super bland department stores and everything.
Do they have Walmart there under another name or anything like that?
Interestingly, Walmart came in and failed.
So, like, Target in Canada, basically.
Completely failed. And so their solution was to buy an existing chain called Seiyu.
Uh-huh.
And kind of make that their, like, inroads into Japan. I don't remember the exact reason, but I remember hearing that it was something along the lines of that the like, having super low prices did not go over well.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's odd in the context of, like, the fact that 100 yen shops are everywhere.
Yeah.
But it just, there's something about Walmart's, like, fundamental, like, presentation that simply did not work in Japan. So
right.
They, like, basically left and brought in and bought an existing Japanese chain. Now, in small towns, like, I never lived in a small town, so it could be different.
Right.
But I would not be shocked at all if, like, there was a sense of kind of losing the culture in light of excessive commercialism.
Right, because that's definitely a theme in Persona 4. A lot of people don't like Juness, but of course they shop there. It's a classic Walmart thing. You think, you know, Canada, we're always bitching about Walmart and we're always shopping there.
Yeah, I think that maybe in America, like, people are going, oh, these small mom and pop shops are being destroyed and by, like, these big soulless corporations and everything.
Mm-hmm.
In Japan, it's more a sense of we are losing who we are.
Right.
We are losing our identity.
Exactly.
Culture. We are losing all of our traditions and becoming homogenized with the West.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe you're seeing that being reflected a little bit in the basically the presence that Juness has throughout the story.
Right. That makes sense.
All right, that's been another Persona 4 Golden Report. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, drop us a line. You can reach me at cat.bailey@usgamer.net. Of course, you can reach me on Twitter at @_catbot or Nadia at Nadia Oxford. Just let us know what your thoughts are. We love to hear from you, and we may read your letter on the show.
Yes.
All right, let's keep going, Nadia.
Let's.
Okay, news time. First bit of news really quickly. A Pillars of Eternity sequel is getting crowdfunding on the Fig.
On the Fig.
Which is very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing you didn't play Pillars of Eternity when it first came out?
No, I didn't.
Are you familiar with it?
Yes, a little bit. Is that the one that Obsidian did?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, so I am, like, a little bit familiar with it, definitely.
Yes. So I played it. It's an isometric RPG.
All right.
Kind of along the lines of Baldur's Gate. You have six members in your party. It's basically in real time, but you can pause it and, like, give lots of directions and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Tyranny was I wouldn't call it a stripped-down version, but it was a much more simplified and accessible version of...
Right.
Pillars of Eternity. Apparently, we'll be picking up directly after the end of the original game.
Oh, that's compelling.
Yep. The statue of Cade Nua, which was supposed to be a side quest in the original game, will be the focus of Deadfire.
Oh.
And I love how portentous all of this is. Eothus has returned. The god of light and rebirth was thought dead. He now inhabits the stone titan that sat buried under your keep, Cade Nua, for decades. Ripping his way out of the ground, he destroyed your stronghold and left you at the brink of death. To save your soul, you must track down the wayward god and demand answers. Answers which could throw mortals and the gods themselves into chaos.
Gasp. I just love the old-fashioned, like, ask God for answers thing. It's like, yeah, good luck with that.
I'm sad that my stronghold's been destroyed. I put a lot of work into that thing.
Yeah, so am I. I mourn for your stronghold, Kat.
I love strongholds. My strongholds are my favorite thing.
You spent
thing,
how many hours
ones.
In Fallout 4 building settlements?
So many settlements. Oh my god. My lighthouse, like castle lighthouse, and I had like 3 settlements. It was great. I will, of course, play this. I'm really interested to see how they improve the graphics, how they improve the battle system, how they, hopefully we get new strongholds and that it's a little better than last time. A lot of people kind of acknowledge the strongholds as kind of a weakness of the previous game.
Well, they're all destroyed now.
In part because the strongholds were a weakness because they were so empty.
Right.
So you did not have a really good sense of like how they were impacting things. Like you didn't get a lot of good feedback from them.
Mm-hmm.
So you were building stuff, but it didn't seem like anything like that it was really helping you in any substantial way. So it was kind of a little bit of a letdown.
Right.
In the grand scheme of things. But apparently they're going to be doing new lighting, new shadows engines. There's going to be dynamic weather, intense and immersive dynamic weather. Rains, fierce winds, and sandstorms are among the harsher conditions that are commonplace in Deadfire. You'll even hear the rain pounding on the roof when you go inside.
That's pretty cool.
Interestingly enough, apparently it's picking up basically directly from where the last game off. And in fact, if you have a saved game, you can carry that over to the sequel.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's great, because I put like 60 hours into this game. It's a big game.
Yeah, apparently. Is it like, I'm not sure how Fig works, but is it funded yet, or?
I am actually not entirely sure.
Mm-hmm.
That is worth looking at. Yes, it is. It's been funded.
Oh, nice. Nicely done.
Yep. It was funded like really fast. Like there's 28 days left and it just passed the goal. It's, they were going for 1.1 million. They're up to 1,110,421.
Wow. Good for them. I think, Banner Saga 3 is also being kickstarted. I don't think it's quite there yet, but it's just started, and it's pretty close, so.
Did you like Banner Saga?
Ah, shit. You know, I've always meant to play it, and it looks great, but I never got it around to it.
Hmm.
I know you didn't like it very much, did you?
It bored me a little bit.
Yeah.
All right. Let's keep moving, because actually running a little bit out of time. I'm kind of running late on something, so.
Us running out of time?
Oh my gosh, we're going to do that thing where we talk for literally an hour, and then I'm like, oh, crap. But no, I actually have an appointment in 20 minutes, so I need to wrap this up. All right, so another piece of news this week. Pokemon Bank finally came out.
Yes, it did. I bet you're happy.
I am so happy, Nadia. I wrote an article this week. I was like, Pokemon Bank's out. The fun can finally begin.
Yeah, I saw your Flareon. Congratulations on your very decorated Flareon.
Oh my god, I love that Flareon. I realized, I was like, so after I finished Sun and Moon, I actually went back to Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire.
Uh-huh.
Because I wanted to get all of the possible ribbons for Flareon,
mm-hmm.
which meant I had to complete all of the contests. And if you complete all of the contests at the master rank, you'll get like a contest master ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and did that. And that involved like growing a lot of berries, like... like putting the right moves on my Flareon, and I was able to dominate the competition and get nice. all of the ribbons. So I was very happy with that, and making sure that I had some other ribbons that I would not be able to get in Sun and Moon. And then once I did that, I transferred everybody over.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so relieved to be in Sun and Moon because it's so much better than Omega Ruby.
You get to leave behind the stink place and go to the good place.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like Omega Ruby was bad or anything, but like the graphics of Sun and Moon are way better.
Yeah.
The interface is one more attractive. I love that I can carry a full party around with me. And Like, it's really funny. Like, I keep going into my party to, like, use Fly or whatever and go, oh, yeah, no, I don't need an HM slave anymore. Yay.
They're all free. All Pokemon are free, finally.
So, literally, the first thing I did was I went and took on the Elite Four so that I could get the Alola ribbon for my Flareon. And so that was all done. I am currently in the middle of the Battle Tree.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because here's the funny thing about the Battle Tree. It is kind of a test for high-level players. It's like going, oh, do you have the monsters and the know-how to be able to live through a succession of increasingly cheap battles? But here's the kicker. You can't bring items with you from game to game, which is a pain in the ass.
Right.
And and in order to get the items that you need, you have to play through the battle tree, get battle points, and invest them in the items that you need.
Right.
Stuff like Life Orb, which improves your attack by 1.5 percent, or it's like 1.25%, but at the expense of some of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Or Choice Band, which improves your attack by 1.5%. Or Choice Specs, or Choice Scarf, or all of the Mega Evolution Stones. Unfortunately, like, my Mega Mawile and my Mega Charizard were two of my most powerful monsters from the last game.
Right.
And they're both useless because the Mega Evolution from Mawile never even showed up in this game. Like, it's not in
that's right.
For some reason.
Yeah.
And maybe they'll distribute it. I hope so. And the Mega Evolution for Charizard is also, like, you have to win 20 battles in a row.
Wow.
And then beat Red in order to get the Mega Charizard X, which is kind of annoying because this battle tree is harder than usual.
That's where you can kind of use the whole Mega Evolution thing.
Usually with these battle towers, like, it starts out, like, kind of, you know, really easy, right?
Yeah.
And you can kind of blow through it and get to the, like, you're, like, fighting basic evolutions. You're, like, one hit KOing. This time, like, it's, like, not beating around the bush. Like, it's basically the Super Singles version where you're fighting fully evolved Pokemon. And there's, like, so many, like, monsters to account for that it's really, really, really tough to account for them with just three monsters in your party.
Yeah. I actually noticed with Sun and Moon, the Elite Four gave me a really hard time for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, they're a little tougher than usual.
Yeah, so they're pretty serious about challenging you, like, towards that end of the game.
Yeah. So the party I have right now that's actually working for me okay, maybe it was Gyarados, Scizor, and Volcarona. I think that was it. Yeah, that might be it. Because
right.
Gyarados is able to power up and is very powerful and is also kind of tanky.
Yes.
Scizor is able to handle the dragons and stuff and is also pretty tanky and pretty powerful. And Volcarona can also, like, use this move called Quiver Dance.
Yes.
That powers up its special attack, special defense, and speed. Which makes it, like, kind of a nightmare to take down. I don't think it's especially powerful, and I don't think it's especially popular in the metagame right now, but it's good.
Now, someone on Twitter was saying that they've gone up against your Infernape, and it's no joke.
Oh, Infernape. Long outdated.
Aw.
Yeah, sadly. The moveset is from, like, three generations ago. And the spread, and this was before the Iron Fist hidden ability came around, and it's totally outdated. But he's my buddy. I've had him for ages. He even had a little shiny for me.
Aww.
He had a shiny baby for me. So.
Aww. He loves
you. Yeah, Infernape's my buddy. I don't use him in competitive battle anymore, but I use him, you know, just when I'm traveling around.
Yeah.
Yeah,
just for fun.
Fun to have around. So now, like, I'm just inclined to do everything, right? I'm going to go catch all of the Ultra Beasts, and we're going to go catch all of the Tapus, which Tapus are so OP in this game right now. So.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I was playing, I was actually on Pokemon Showdown, which is the browser version of the battle system.
Oh, cool.
And everybody and their mother has a Tapu on their team. Tapu, Tapu, Tapu. Tapu for days.
Tapus forever.
My gosh. So, yeah, no, I'm really enjoying it. Nadia, you don't have anything to import from Pokemon Bank, do you?
No, pretty much. One of these days I'll bring over my old Pokemon from Pokemon Red somehow, but I don't really use the Pokebank very much. I just kind of fall in love with a whole new set of friends.
Aw.
Yeah.
See, no, I kick him to the curb. Screw them.
Even Litten?
Oh, especially Litten.
No!
I don't like Incineroar.
I love Incineroar.
Nah, he looks dumb. I much prefer Decidueye.
Well, he's pretty cool, I have to admit.
He's got that kind of emo, like, the hair over the eye that they're always kind of blowing out of the way.
Yeah, someone was mentioning that he's actually based on a type of Hawaiian owl that's extinct, hence the ghost type, but I don't know if that's true or not.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. I always make it a point to train at least one monster that I really like from each generation.
Mm-hmm.
Last generation, I trained up a Greninja.
Mm-hmm.
I should have trained up an Aegislash. And actually, I hope it's not too late because I transferred like basically everything. So I might have a hard time breeding it in X and Y. But yeah, in any case, this one I might breed a Mimikyu.
I love Mimikyu so much.
It's really good.
It's good, like, isn't it?
It's a really powerful monster.
That one false hit really can even things out.
So helpful. Especially because while they're trying to hit you, like, you can do a sword stance, and then you can use, like, Shadow Sneak. Or you can use a Z-Crystal attack to do, like, insane damage.
Yeah.
And I've been able to finish off many an enemy on Pokemon Showdown using Mimikyu. So, all right. Last thing before we go on to the Torment Tides of Numenera. Nadia, really quick thoughts on Dragon Quest VIII.
Oh, I love it. It's not nearly as pretty as the PlayStation 2 version, but I think we all expected that.
Yeah, of course.
I've noticed a lot of pop-up that probably wasn't there in the original Dragon Quest. Although, I've heard complaints about slowdown, and I haven't seen anything, but I am playing on a new Nintendo 3DS. Maybe that has to do with it. And maybe the complaints were for the Japanese version of the game.
I think it was a problem with Pokemon as well. Like, there was a lot more slowdown on the old 3DS.
Really?
I guess that's what I heard.
Yeah, I could see that being the case, because, I mean, both, like, Dragon Quest VIII and Pokemon Sun and Moon are... They really push the 3DS to the limit, let's face it.
I'm surprised Dragon Quest VIII isn't a new 3DS exclusive. Like, so they really just dropped that whole idea, right?
They really
did.
They did
it once with Xenoblade and went, yeah, screw it.
Yeah, good enough.
It's going to split the... They're splitting the party, as it were.
I'm just really glad that, like... Dragon Quest VIII, you can play as Red, because I've always liked Red.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to replace Jessica, so.
I've been kind of wondering which version I should play. Which version should I play, Nadia?
Oh, probably the 3DS version. When's
really
the last time
the
you
PS2
played
one?
Dragon Quest VIII?
Years ago.
Okay, so.
Like 10 years ago.
It's definitely a great game to have on the go, like a lot of Dragon Quest games.
So I'm going to Europe next month.
Nice.
And I'm deciding which RPG I want to bring with me.
It's
and I was kind of, because I'm done with SD Gundam. It's finished. It's over. But so I'm like going, okay, now what? And I was kind of eyeballing one of three.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon Quest VIII.
Okay.
Persona 3 Portable.
Mm-hmm.
Or Chrono Trigger.
Chrono Trigger, I guess the DS version?
Yeah, because I have the DS version. I never finished it. I have started many a time. I have never gotten around to wrapping it up. I also have Earthbound on my 3DS, so I'm kind of inclined to bring my 3DS with me and play one of those games. But
play
I'm,
them all.
Like, trying to decide... And plus, it will allow me to kind of do some more work on Pokemon.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, knock out a bunch of stuff. Like, I was playing, when I was coming home from LA yesterday, I was, like, playing basically Pokemon the entire way. Failing miserably in the battle tree.
How long is a flight from LA anyway to San Fran?
Just an hour.
Yeah, so that's not too bad. So
but, you know, LAX is a freaking nightmare. So
yeah, no kidding.
I was sitting in the terminal for like 2 hours, like just kind of messing around with the battle tree and desperately wishing I were in bed.
My life. I would honestly go with Dragon Quest VIII. Have you, of course, you've played and finished Chrono Trigger on like SNES, right?
No, I've never finished it. Yep. My darkest secret.
Oh yeah, my God.
I have an excuse.
Okay, let's hear this.
I got a Super Nintendo in 2000. By that time, Chrono Trigger was already quite rare.
Oh, yeah, you're not going to find it anymore by that point, unless you want to pay, like, $50 million. Okay, I accept this excuse.
I didn't want to play it on emulator.
Okay.
And so it took many years. And then finally it came out on DS, and I got it on the DS. And for whatever reason, it just did not stick.
Mm-hmm.
And I've tried time and again to try and like sit down and like just play it. But
right.
Funny thing about being in the games press is that you have all of the games.
You do.
All of the games in the world. And so I'm like sitting here like trying to finish up Chrono Trigger, but I've also got, I don't know, everything else on my plate. And this is like the 1 month where I have like a little bit of a window.
Right.
To play games, and I wasted it on ST Gundam. God damn it. I feel guilty.
Well, I think everyone in the games press is guilty of playing something that they shouldn't be playing in favor of, like, you know, instead of playing what they should be playing.
Yeah. So that happened. And then, of course, next month is looming, and you got Horizon and the Switch and Zelda and, of course, Mass Effect Andromeda is just around the corner. And the next thing I know, it's going to be back to the grind. So I'm kind of like, what is the one game I can, like, knock out and feel good about myself? And I think it might be Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, I'm going to have to be honest with you. Dragon Quest VIII is not as long and as huge as at Dragon Quest VII, but it is very substantial. Whereas Chrono Trigger is a very, not exactly short, but it's a very compact sort of game.
Persona 3 Portable is also a huge game.
Yeah, exactly. So I would have to say give Chrono Trigger DS a try again. Where do you keep on getting stuck?
The part where you go to the future for the first time.
Oh, the Pink Floyd future, as my brother used to call it.
Yeah, and you get the robot?
Yeah, Robo.
That's usually when I check out.
Oh, any reason why?
That's exactly where I am right now.
Just because it's despairing and horrible and blank and bleak?
I don't know. Like, I just get through the opening parts. And I see, like, the kind of the interesting premise.
Mm-hmm.
I get to the future. I get the robot. And then I, like, put it away for a while. And then the next thing... And then I get to the point where it's, like, too far into the game to remember exactly what I was doing.
Right.
But not far enough.
Right.
And so I go, oh, I'll just start over.
Yeah,
and the process begins anew.
It is the curse. Actually been there several times with Breath of Fire 4, so I understand.
All right, I'm narrowing it down then. So it's either Persona 3 Portable or Chrono Trigger, one of the two. Because P3 Portable would be really good to finish up before P5 comes out.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe our viewers have, or listeners have a few suggestions. I would say
yes.
Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, like, let me know. What do you think? Should I play P3 Portable or should I play Chrono Trigger? It will in fact, what I talk about on the show, so... Send me your thoughts. Drop me a line on the DM or send me an email at cat.bailey@usgamer.net or, you know, do the Twitter thing.
We should do a Chrono Trigger report the way that I do the Persona report.
Well, hopefully I'll be done with it by the time I get back from Europe.
It'll be a very long...
So it'll be a one-part Chrono Trigger report.
One-part report.
All right, Nadia?
Yes.
I have to go, but...
Your planet needs
to. You don't have to go. In fact, you should stay because... There is a Torment Tides of Numenera interview, and it is coming up next.
Good times.
All right, I'm here with Brian Fargo and George Zeitz, and we are going to be talking about Torment Tides of Numenera, which is coming out at the end of February. Oh my God, it's almost here. It feels like we've been waiting for a long time. Maybe as long as, like, since 1999 for this game. It's pretty crazy. I just got a chance to play it, actually. There were many tentacles everywhere, monsters from another world. I talked a poor mercenary into walking into the maw,
yes.
Which didn't strike me as a very nice thing to do. Was that me being mean, or was that just like they were bad and it was okay?
We don't judge.
We don't judge.
We don't judge. There was a way to avoid that.
Whoa, there was.
I could have saved him. Yep, there
I could have saved him. Yeah. I'm sure there was
but
multiple
that doesn't
ways.
Make you a bad person. Nah, it's okay.
And so there were like multiple areas that I could have gone to. Is that like, so there were like three different areas with malls, I assume, and I could have like done one of three different types of kind of puzzles?
You could have done, no, there's actually a bunch of different malls, and each of them is a puzzle in and of itself.
Gotcha.
That particular mall you did have to solve in order to get through the main critical path. But the way, there were many different ways you could have done it. You actually could have saved that guy's life. You actually could have even offered yourself to the maw if you had done the right
thing. I totally did.
In lieu of him.
I offered myself to the maw, but it was like, just kind of licked me. I was like, no.
Yeah,
no.
You had to do the right thing ahead of time.
Not tasty.
Yeah. But you could have if you tried harder.
By the way, I just wanted to welcome you back to the podcast, Brian. Last time you were here, you were playing Wasteland. We were talking about Wasteland 3. Man, you're a busy guy these days.
I'm very busy, but at least I'm sitting here saying I'm done with Torment and we're not out. Now it's completed, it's coming, so that's nice.
Yeah,
so it's
no
nice
thing.
To have one under your belt. They're, you know, every game is hard to finish.
Absolutely. You know, when it comes to Torment, Tides of Numenera, you know, a lot of people say Planescape Torment is the best RPG story ever.
Yeah.
It's a tough act to follow.
I know. We must be gluttons for punishment, huh? Yeah. Well, not only that, but I find that with people, with any number of the older games, but this one especially, is that you are competing not with just the material, but their memory of the material, which can be quite different than the reality of it. So, but yeah, but I felt that we had a special opportunity because a lot of the people who had worked on the original Planescape Torment or had created Planescape itself were all around and all available, and it was a one-time shot to get the band together to do this.
What did you guys feel like was most especially important to nail with this game? To be able to get people who are like, you know, of course, old Torment fans coming back in, but also new people as well.
I'll give my opinion, and I'm sure Brian has his own too. For me, it's the weirdness of it. Planescape Torment was just wonderfully strange. It was so inventive and bizarre, and every character that you would talk to would have a unique voice and their own very strange story. And being able to reproduce that was something that was very much foremost on my mind as we were working on this game.
For sure, the otherworldliness, and I think the emphasis on the written word. There's only so much you can do visually. There's some things with words that can create that you couldn't possibly create all the visuals in this game that we tell in text. And I think there are people that gravitate towards that kind of style of entertainment. And also that combat isn't the major emphasis of the game. And even in this game, there are combats, but there aren't a lot. There's no trash mobs, and you can often talk your way out of it. And I think the de-emphasis of that in an RPG is also appeals to people.
You were talking about the otherworldliness being like a key ingredient. One thing that strikes me about Torment is that it is a setting reminiscent of D&D, but it's obviously not that. And so it's kind of walking this fine line. Like, how hard is it walking that line and like kind of nailing it without, you know, infringing, obviously?
On the D&D?
Yeah.
I think in this particular game, I didn't feel too much tension against D&D. We were basing the world off of Monty Cook's Numenera, which feels like a different sort of a thing. It's inspired more by like Gene Wolfe's New Sun books. It's that dying earth feel, which is, I don't think D&D has ever done anything quite like that. So it was fairly easy to hit the tone when it came to the world.
So, talking really quickly a little bit about isometric RPGs, like as a genre, Wasteland, Pillars of Eternity, Torment now, a little bit of a renaissance going on for that style. Nostalgia obviously plays a role, but there also seems to be something about this particular style that really seems to speak to people. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that one of it is that when you're going isometric, you can often offer more choices because the visual payoff necessary in a first or third person can be tricky. These games are very deep because we put in a lot of things that you wouldn't see on a normal playthrough. And so we can do things fairly inexpensively, but pay off 25 different sort of attacks at something. Whereas if you were in a first person, that would be a whole other order of business. So I think that the deep and nuanced cause and effect, I think, is a byproduct of being isometric that people really gravitate towards. And there's also, from our good old Dungeons and Dragons days of looking at graph paper or miniatures, you're controlling often a squad of people, and so there's a greater ability for tactics. So I think perhaps those might be two of the things, other than nostalgia. I don't know if you would add to that.
I pretty much agree.
Yeah, when I look at an isometric game, like my first thought is, or an isometric RPG in this style, my first thought is, well, this game's going to be really dense and interesting, so I'm definitely going to like this one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this is dense. Interesting. I think you'll be happy with this. This one's about as dense as they get.
But at the same time, it's a little intimidating, too, right? Because people look at this kind of older style of graphics and go, oh, that's going to be really dense and interesting. Right. I don't know.
Yeah. Too interesting.
Too interesting for me.
Yeah. Well, we do try to kind of lure you in slowly with the intro. In fact, when we first put it into early access, that was the biggest feedback, was that it was just too much too soon. So we really simplified the beginning so we could sort of digest the material a little bit slower than have it sort of open up. But the main thing is that. When you start playing, yes, it's dense, but you don't have to do anything. I think that's the mental thing we like to get people over, which is, yeah, there's 40 things you can go do, but it's okay. You don't need to do them all. Just pick one or two and off you go. And the critical path tends to reveal itself, so you don't have to worry about all those things.
Planescape's like kind of main theme was questioning what can change like a person's nature. Oh, what is Torment's main theme?
It's legacy. It's what does one life matter is the question that orients a lot of the content in the game. And what you'll find is that a lot of the quests and characters in the game are in some way wrestling with the question of legacy or answering the question what does one life matter in their own way. That was something that we were not only just thinking about from the perspective of the main story, but also from a lot of the side stories that you'll encounter.
Or how do the sub-characters kind of relate to that theme and the main character's development?
How do the sub-characters relate
like
to
the characters that are kind of in your party, like, how are they developed with that theme in mind?
So, yeah, I mean, they all sort of have their own take on the theme. I don't know how deeply we want to talk about individual characters.
Maybe just give me a quick example.
Sure. So, let's see. Calistige is, she's the character, visually, she's quite interesting. She's the one who is... she's got like echoes of herself from other dimensions or other realities all around her at all times. And she, her story is she's trying to figure out whether she should return to humanity and sort of become a normal person again, or whether she should ascend into the data sphere, into the other dimensions. And she is sort of, and it is for her something of a question of legacy and what she can accomplish as this being with who's off in the multiverse, and she ascends to this greater level, almost becomes a goddess. She feels like she can accomplish a lot more and know a lot more, or if she should come back to the world and pull back from that craziness. And that sort of question of what she can achieve is something that you'll wrestle with her.
She should totally ascend into the data sphere.
I think she should too.
And speaking like normality is totally overrated. I would ascend into the data sphere if I could right now. That'd be great.
I think a lot of us probably would.
Yeah, especially this last.
Yeah,
exactly. That was a reasonably
good plan.
Just upload my consciousness into the internet, free-floating Catherine.
Yep,
right. Who's to say you haven't already done so?
It's true that I'm a disembodied voice spread across the world as we speak. That was the sound of my mind exploding, by the way, because we don't have video on this audio podcast. So, Planescape, the kind of the resurrection of the nameless one results in the death of someone else. But in Torment, resurrection grants life, like, because you have the chosen, or the god, who is, like, moving along and kind of leaving these husks, and that husk becomes a new person. I found that dichotomy really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting, too. That was invented by Colin, our lead writer. I don't know if he was intentionally echoing that, but it does sort of, it is sort of an interesting reversal.
So Colin was the one who invented it, but do you have any insight into why you decided to take the approach of life versus death?
I don't. I mean, I do know that we initially were thinking about the game as a life cycle. If you look at the first part of the game in the city of Saga's Cliffs, we intentionally went with sort of brighter environments. A lot of the characters are it's a little lighter overall. It's not quite as dark as it gets in the area that you played. You saw a pretty dark part of the game, the blue. And as you move forward, the environments get a little bit darker, the subject matter gets a little bit darker, and you kind of get that sense of a life cycle moving across the course of the game until the very end. So that could have been part of what he was trying to echo.
Yeah, that is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Obviously, Torment is a very story-driven RPG. There's this kind of a sliding scale for RPGs where some focus really heavily on combat, almost to the exclusion of any story whatsoever. Your classical first-person dungeon crawlers like Wizardry and, exactly. and that kind of thing. Why have you guys, why does Torment go so far to the other side where it's just story is our thing, story is what we do, this is the core of the entire game, and combat is just one smaller element as opposed to a much more important aspect of it?
I think the biggest thing is we're essentially trying to follow the example of the content that came before, the Planescape Torment. Brian, you might be able to speak better to what happened, why Planescape Torment went that way, but we very much wanted to be true to our backers and the kind of experience that they were expecting of the spiritual successor to Planescape Torment, which is why we went that way, but you might...
That's most certainly why this went that way. But I think that's one of the things I like about role-playing games is they come in all these different shapes and sizes, and that people who don't really understand the genre see it as one big thing, right? But if you understand it, there is the nuances of it all, right? And so you gave a perfect example with the dungeon crawl, which the combat is everything. And having now working on Bard's Tale 4, it's on the other side of the scale of where Torment is, which is combat is a very large part of it. Combat and exploration, that is kind of the core loop. And it's not that there'll be no story, but where Torment is on the other side, and I think that the doing a spiritual successor, it dictated that we follow that path, because that's what they would have wanted to see if we do that. And plus, these guys are all wonderful writers, so it's great to turn them loose.
And I suppose by not focusing as much on combat, it gives you a lot more space to figure out how to deal with the consequences of your actions and all of the different things, because my understanding is that Planescape goes really deep down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I would say that's true. Combat in the original Planescape was probably not the absolute best feature of that game, and we really wanted to take it down a much more interesting and rich kind of direction. We wanted to insert the sort of storytelling and the dialogue and the choices and consequences into the combat experience. And so now we have the crisis system, which you saw some of, where that is, you can talk to people in combat, you can convince them not to attack you, or you can interact with objects, which is something that you really don't see in a lot of RPGs.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most interesting, innovative things that we do in the game. And for people that we've been doing role-playing games our whole life, we try to think about ways we can push it as an art form, and different things we can experiment with. And I think for this Torment game, I think that's where we really pushed it somewhere where people really haven't done a lot with in terms of, because most combat, you either kill them or they kill you, maybe you can run away. And those are tended to be your only three choices, where this goes down a whole different path about talking your way out of it or killing one person and affecting the change of what the other people do. We just made it just those micro sections deeper.
You've heard many RPGs promise that there will be consequences to your actions, and that one action will cause multiple other things to happen. Right. But so often it ends up being kind of disappointing because there's a finite amount of time to make a game, and at some point you got to wrap it up. And right. People come out going, "Well, that didn't really impact my decisions." How does Torment avoid falling into that kind of trap?
3.5 years. So that really is. If you saw, I wish we could show you some of the dialogue that we wrote and the way they branch. It's really incredible. One of the unfortunate things, and I can't certainly can't speak for every RPG, but one of the unfortunate things for a lot of RPGs is people do come out of them sometimes saying, oh man, it didn't really feel like my choices really made that much of a difference. But what they don't realize is that they actually did. It's just that they only played through it once, so they don't realize that it could have gone off in a lot of other different directions. I think sometimes as designers, we don't necessarily showcase enough that, hey, look, your choice did this, and if you had done this other thing, it would have turned out very different. We've tried to do that a little bit more in Torment, but even so, there are probably things in Torment where if you didn't play through it multiple times, you wouldn't realize that there was all this reactivity that that you could sometimes play through things three, four, or five times and have a different experience each time.
Talking a little bit about Torment, I played Torment on a console. That, you know, like back in 1999, I would not really have been able to imagine playing a game like this on a console. Kind of tells you how consoles and PCs are closer than ever. Like, what were some of the challenges for you guys in translating this in a usable way to the PS4 and the Xbox One?
Well, I think the first part you hit on the nose, which is that the hardware are comparable now between PC. And in fact, a lot of the people who loved Planescape Torment are really happy that we're on console because they've not always kept their PCs up to speed in terms of from a hardware specs perspective, so it offers something for them. You know, you can plug it in and go. We had already had a positive experience with Wasteland 2 on console in terms of both its reception and the ability to do the work, so we already kind of knew what we were doing there. So it really was a function of getting the radial interface down. And the other thing is, there could be no compromise to the PC whatsoever, zero, period, end of story. And the PC, we didn't even think about console until much later on. So we had to not change a darn thing and have them have completely different interfaces. Find out that actually some Steam owners say, hey, prefer playing with a controller, so great, we support it on PC if you want. And then that and the font size is the big thing, right? You are, instead of 12 inches, you're 6 feet away, so you got to support it that way. But based upon today, we got pretty good reception, great reception from people who are not PC-based and just pure console press that was sitting back on the couch going, guess what, I could see myself sitting here for hours at a time doing it. So I think mission accomplished there.
Yeah, I think that it's important that it's on console just in the sense of it opens up kind of the ability for so many people to actually be able to play this game who otherwise would not be able to. Like the fact that it would be on, say, the PS4 or the Xbox One just brings in a lot of people, like a whole different audience. And actually, come to think of that, that might be a little challenging for you too, because, I mean, there's the hardcore PC RPG audience, and then there's the console RPG experience audience, and they might be like looking for something totally different, right?
Right. Well, sometimes you just got to make the game that you want to make and let the chips fall where they may. And Torment's too good not to share it with more people.
So, as split-offs of Black Isle, In Exile, and Obsidian both revived a few classic franchises in new forms. And I know that you're working on Bard's Tale at the moment, if I'm not mistaken. Is there another RPG that you'd like to revive, or are you kind of looking to make something new going forward?
I don't have one in particular that I'm really happy with the franchises that we have, and I definitely want to do some original stuff also. The act of crowdfunding, part of it, there's a nostalgic part that helps you finance, right? Which is that, it's hard to do it unless there's an established loyal base of people who are really into something. But as our stature has grown, I think we will have a greater ability to say just the fact that we're doing it, that we become the thing, not just the brand itself, and so that'll open up our abilities to experiment more.
Last question. You've kind of turned Planescape into, not Planescape, sorry. Mm-hmm. You kind of made Wasteland into, I don't know, mini franchise, because you've got Wasteland 3 now. Do you see something similar happening to Torment Tides of Numenera, or is this kind of a standalone?
For now, it's a standalone. There's no intention or conversation of talking about rolling on to something else. These products just feel different, in that way. So it's not to say we would never revisit it, but we're just not thinking about it now.
Great. So, Torment Tides of Numenera is coming out February 28th on the Xbox One, PS4, and PC. Any looks, looking at the Switch at all? Any interest?
What do you mean?
The Nintendo Switch?
Oh, no.
Not possible.
Whoa!
Not possible.
Whoa, just dropping bombs right here. Nope, no Nintendo Switch here.
I like Nintendo, but that's not going to happen on that machine. Plus, you know, that's not the audience. I mean, can you imagine a Nintendo game with a million words? that was a complete mismatch.
All right, then. And on that note, we are wrapping up. Thank you, guys. Have a good day.
All right, that's the end of our episode. You can find Axe of the Blood God on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, wherever podcasts are sold. It is a US Gamer podcast, of course. Follow us on all of the social media channels. It's US GamerNet. Sorry, my Final Fantasy IV playthrough has been on hold for a little bit because I've been very, very busy. Apologize, Gomena
Sai. She's a very busy girl.
I'm going to pick it up next week, perhaps. Follow me on Twitter, @_catbot, Nadia at Nadia Oxford. Please leave us a review on iTunes. I've noticed that people have been, there have been more reviews lately. I really appreciate it. It's really nice of you. Like, very nice reviews. I'm glad that you're enjoying the show. The Blood God is pleased.
Very.
Very pleased. Of course, check out Nadia on Tiny Girl, Tiny Games, and check out all of the interesting coverage that is going on. Jeremy just wrapped up his Design in Action series on Symphony of the Night, and next month he's going to be doing Last Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a bunch of Resident Evil 7 coverage.
We do.
And if you haven't, check out my Monday column, Starting Screen, in which I talk about a bit about what's going on in the games industry, and also kind of round up the news and talk about the stuff that I kind of find interesting. Check that out as well. But in any case, thanks for dropping by, everybody. As always, it's been fun talking RPGs. whenever I'm like, oh, I'm gonna do a short episode today, it ends up not being a short episode. All right, so let me know if I should play Chrono Trigger or Persona 3 Portable or Dragon Quest 8 or something else. Like, maybe I'm missing out on something. Maybe I should play Earthbound instead. So send me a line in that regard. In any case, thanks for dropping by as always. And until next time, I've been Cat Bailey, and for Nadia Oxford and myself, we'll see you again next week. Until then, happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons, oder Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser Bestes.